I would just like to introduce our speaker tonight. Her name is Patricia Major. She's currently the editor of Michigan History Magazine. She has a BA in journalism from CMU and a master's in historical preservation from EMU. And she's here tonight to talk to us about her wonderful book, Ladies of the Lights. And so with no further ado, please join me in welcoming Patricia Major.
Well, good evening. Good evening. All right. Thank you all for coming out, and thanks to my friends and family supporting me tonight, and happy Women's History Month. By national charter, this is Women's History Month every year. My presentation tonight is on the female lighthouse keepers of Michigan. Let me give you a little background as to how I came to write about this subject, why it interested me, and works. Prior to the job that I currently have, which is at the editor at Michigan History Magazine, I was the assistant director and curator at the Michigan Women's Historical Center in Lansing. And that is sort of a repository of history, obviously relating to Michigan women, and the only museum in the state that's dedicated to that. And so when we would develop exhibits there, it would always focus on that. It wouldn't necessarily be broad scope of women's history, but what did women in Michigan do that we can talk about? And in thinking of an exhibit, this was back in 2007, I think, I had read an article, oddly enough, in Michigan History Magazine, about a keeper at Sandpoint Escanaba Lighthouse, and her name was Mary Terry. And the article was a cover story and quite extensive on the inside, partly because it was a woman and not many people knew there were women keepers, but she was one of two women who died on the job. And her case, in her case, it was a mystery because she had died in a fire that some felt was set to cover up a crime. She was known to be a well-to-do woman. She owned parcels of land in the area, saved her money. And there was just this feeling that in this isolated lighthouse, she may have been robbed, and then the fire was set to cover that. And she unfortunately died in the fire, and her body was so damaged by the fire, they really couldn't determine the cause of her death. In that article, there was a list of 50-plus women who had served either as keepers or assistant keepers. And, you know, not only had I not known there was one, Mary Terry, I did not know there were 50-plus more. So I guess that just sort of stuck in my head for a while. And so when it came time to do this exhibit, to come up with an exhibit idea, that popped into my head, partly because it was a fascinating subject, but Michigan has the most lighthouses in the nation, and as a result had the most keepers and the most female keepers. So I thought this is something that we as Michiganders can really trumpet and be proud of, that we, you know, played such an important role in maritime history. So we pulled together the exhibit, and it was very well attended, and it's still traveling around the state. And then with that, I pitched the idea to U of M Press, and they said, yes, we think that would make a good book. So thank you to U of M Press. Let me give you a few statistics about, just broadly, no pun intended, broadly speaking, about Michigan ladies of the lights. They served a span of 105 years. The first lighthouse in Michigan opened in 1832. The first female was serving as a keeper just 17 years later. And the last woman to serve ended her term in 1954. And that was actually about 30 years beyond what most women were serving around the United States. There was a changeover in technology at that time, and women were being phased out. In the 30s, the Coast Guard took over the lighthouse service, which had been under various departments, including the Department of Treasury. They had certain ideas about whether women should be serving a purpose like that in the in their ranks. So women really were phased out in the 20s and 30s in most cases throughout the United States. But this one woman, whom I'll talk about in a little while, served until 1954. There are 52 known female lighthouse keepers or assistant keepers, and I say known because it wouldn't surprise me if we discovered there were more. In the lighthouse records, they sometimes list the keepers only by their first initial, so we have no way of knowing, unless, you know, you dig deeper into each individual keeper, whether they were male or female. And then there are those names that are sometimes, you know, you could interpret either way. But at this point, we know about 52. As I said, more than any other state in the Union. And those women served widely in Michigan. They were on Lakes Huron, Michigan, and Superior, also in the Detroit River. Many of the lighthouses they served at on the lakes are still standing. Most of the lighthouses in the river are not. The river has risen and actually submerged many of the islands that those lighthouses were erected on, so those lighthouses have been replaced with simple beacons. So we can't really see where they served in the Detroit River, but at least they're in the annals of the lighthouse service. Michigan women served a good amount of time on the job, an average of 5.5 years, and nine of them served for 10 years or more. One served for 41 years. Most of them succeeded a husband who died on the job, who had been a keeper there, or they filled in for a husband who might have been absent due to war. Several keepers left to fight in the Civil War, their wives took over, and a couple left during the brief Spanish-American War in 1898, and their wives took over for that period. And then there were women who, after serving that way, were allowed to serve elsewhere because they had proven themselves. But generally speaking, they got into the job initially as a result of either succeeding a deceased husband or filling in for them in an absence. Several of the females were part of families that had many keepers in them. There's a family in Lake Michigan, the Sheridans, who served at a number of lighthouses and it's multiple generations and multiple genders, and the same is true on Lake Huron with the Garrity family. They served in the Presqu'île area, Roger City, Alpena area. And there were women who were lighthouse keepers who had children who later succeeded them in the profession. The first lady of the light we have no photo for. Her family has not found a photo of her, but then she lived at she died in 1860, so that's why. And she served at Point O'Bark. Catherine Shook was her name. She was married to a man named Peter Shook, and he was the first lighthouse keeper there at Point O'Bark. That's at the tip of the thumb. As ships would sail into Saginaw Bay, they would pass that lighthouse. And he served there for 2 years, I believe, and she took sick. And he was very worried about her, and he actually went overland down to Port Huron to find a doctor to help her. The doctor and Peter and a couple of the doctor's assistants sailed back toward the lighthouse and did treat Catherine. And then they went to sail back to Port Huron. Peter went with them to get supplies, and the entire crew of that boat died. They were capsized in Lake Huron. So, you know, if you can imagine the situation, she's out in what was really the middle of nowhere at that point in 1849 at the tip of the thumb. And I don't know how she found out her husband had died, but obviously she did. And she was left to raise their eight children alone while keeping the light. And in just 1 month after she assumed that responsibility in the midst of grieving her husband, their cottage caught on fire, the keeper's cottage. And so she and the eight children were burned out of that, and she couldn't sign for the materials to rebuild it because she was a woman. Let me read a little bit about her story to you. When the lighthouse inspector finally arrived after the cottage had burned, he found Catherine and her children huddled in a small shanty they'd erected. Catherine was suffering from burns she'd sustained while trying to put out the fire. She also suffered the indignity of not being permitted to sign for materials to rebuild her house. Her teenage son signed the forms instead. Fortunately, Catherine was held blameless for the blaze. The inspector theorized that a poorly built chimney was the cause. Her dedication to the light was recognized by the Lighthouse Service, and she continued as its keeper until her voluntary resignation in 1851. So she served for just 2 years, but it was a pretty tough 2 years. I mentioned earlier the Garrities as a lighthouse family that had multiple generations. Mary and Anna Garrity were mother-daughter and are believed to be the only two Michigan ladies of the lights that were related. Mary served her husband, Patrick, as his assistant, and then Anna took over one of the other lights in the area at Presque Isle later in her life. And their family's combined total of years spent as keepers equals 184 years. But between Patrick, the father, and Mary, the daughter, who was the last of the Garrities to serve, that was about a 65-year span. So there were Garrities up there for many years, keeping the lights in Presque Isle. Anna was also the second, I should point out, this is a picture of Anna, not Mary. Anna was the second longest serving woman in Michigan. Obviously, the lady who served for 41 years takes the award for being the one having the most time on duty, but Anna was second longest, 23 years, which was a pretty impressive number, even if male or female. And then we had a lady of the light who served in the Bay City area at the mouth of the Saginaw River. Julia Braun was her name, and she helped her invalid husband until his death and then succeeded him. There were a number of Civil War veterans who had been injured in some way in the Civil War who were given lighthouse keeping duties as sort of a reward for what they had given for their country. But they were disabled in some way, and yet they were expected to take on this enormous task of keeping light lit. So she was one of the women who really, in everything but name, served as the primary keeper, but then finally was named that when he died. One of the tasks that she did while she was on her watch was she oversaw construction of the existing lighthouse there at the mouth of the Saginaw River, and she served as the keeper until she married again. She married a man who was a pilot, a person who led ships up and down the Saginaw River. And when that marriage occurred, she was immediately demoted to his assistant. Then her position was abolished in 1882. Interestingly, at the same time Mary Garrity's position was abolished, the exact same day, the two of them were relieved of duties. And then it was later, just within a few months, it was filled by a man. The longest serving lady was Elizabeth Whitney Williams. Whitney was her maiden name, Van Riper was her first husband, and then Williams was her second husband. Her husband, Clement Van Riper, was the keeper at Beaver Island Harbor Lighthouse, and he died as he tried to save a crew from a stranded ship. She succeeded him and stayed there for 12 years. When she married again, she married a man named Daniel Williams. They decided they wanted to live on the mainland. She requested a transfer to a brand new light, hadn't been served at by anyone yet, Little Traverse Light. And she served there for 29 years. She ended up retiring when she was 71. She wrote an autobiography, which is, I would recommend reading that for a number of reasons. She speaks very poetically about her life as a lighthouse keeper, but she also talks about her earlier life. She was born on Mackinac Island, and eventually her family settled on Beaver Island, and she was there during the time when they had, I can't see if you turn off the lights, unfortunately. James Strang was there, and he was considered the Mormon king of Beaver Island. And there was such animosity between what they called the Gentiles and the Mormons that the Mormons basically took over the island and forced the others to leave. Her family did eventually come back after he was assassinated by her followers. So she speaks of that, too. So it's just a very interesting history of that time in Michigan history. She also speaks about the Native Americans that she encountered and just the beauty of living on the water and the beauty of her island. She also wrote poems. Let me read just a bit of one she wrote about the lighthouse keeping profession. Let our lamps be brightly burning for our brothers out to sea. Then their ships are soon returning. Oh, how glad our hearts will be. There are many that have left us. Nevermore will they return. Left our hearts with sorrows aching. Still our lamps must brightly burn. And those poems are included in her book. It's called A Child of the Sea. And she, in addition to writing herself, she has been written about many times. She is really sort of the rock star of Michigan's female lighthouse keepers. She's the subject of books, both written for adults and children, chapters in books. There is a play written about some key women lighthouse keepers, and she was one of them. There's a children's website about her. So she really has really caught the attention of people over the years. There was one other woman on the Great Lakes who served longer than she did, amazingly. Served 43 years, but 41 years is nothing to sneeze at either. We have a reluctant Lady of the Light. No picture for her, unfortunately, either. Her name was Lucy Gramer, and she was married to the lighthouse keeper at the Ecorse Range Light down in the Detroit River. His name was Gus Gramer, and he was quite a character. He had sailed away to work on, I think it was a whaling ship, had been shipwrecked, had served in many areas in the Great Lakes as a sailor, and then eventually settled down as a lighthouse keeper, but the wanderlust was never far away. And he decided he was going to fight in the Spanish-American War and left her to handle the light in his absence the same month that she bore a child. So that must have been a difficult introduction to the lighthouse keeping profession. Their marriage was rocky, and when she tried to divorce him, he argued their case in the Detroit Tribune. And here's what we had to say about that. The newspaper reported how Gus called upon his wife the other night and urged her to come back with the children and live with him, but she demurred. And after acknowledging how good he had been to her, she fell on her knees, Gus says, and between her sobs confessed that she really preferred a former roomer of the Gramers, although he is not as handsome. Gramer then claimed to have called his old friend in, made the man kneel beside his wife, and placed Lucy's hands in that of the other person. Lucy, he is reported to have said, be good to the children. Charlie, be good to Lucy, as she has been a good wife to me. He told the reporter that he concluded the meeting by taking Lucy and Charlie to an ice cream parlor. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately for Gus, Mrs. Gramer disputed his account, particularly the part about falling on her knees. Mm-hmm. She replied, if Gus was half as good as Charlie, it would be better for him, and there would probably never have been any trouble. When he says that I am going to marry another man as soon as I get a divorce, he is drawing on his imagination. There is no truth in it, and I never fell down on my knees to Gus and confessed anything. Everyone knows that I am full of the old Nick, but everybody except Gus knows also that it is all honest fun and no meanness, and Gus ought to have known that too. Although Gus agreed to give Lucy custody of their children, she didn't trust him to keep his word. She told the paper that she was going to keep a sharp lookout to see that he didn't get any legal advantage when she was not looking. Now, Gus left, they did get divorced. Gus remarried again, a woman named Mary, and he left her for a time to replace him as keeper. So, he had that twice in his history. The last Lady of the Light was named Frances Worry Johnson, And she married a keeper and assisted him at White River, that's just north of Muskegon area on Lake Michigan. They also had a rocky marriage, and both of them left the light. Within a year, though, she petitioned to return as the primary keeper. She was the only Michigan female to serve in the Coast Guard era. And let me read a little bit about her, what she thought of her first husband. I interviewed her for the book and did an oral history interview with her. So I asked her, let's go backwards for a minute. You were Leo's assistant for lighthouse keeping when you were married. You assisted him, right? Assisted him? He didn't do anything. He liked to fish and hunt and stuff like that. That's what he did. He found out that he could do that and I could do all the work. So I, of course, fixed the meals and did the dishes and waxed the floors. The floors were all wooden floors, hardwood. I had to scrub them and then wax them with paste wax and then polish that. Gads! And then I had to keep the light running every single day. She, the interview with her is very entertaining. She's just kind of a feisty character. And she unfortunately, when she went back to be the primary keeper on her own, that went quite well for a while. But then she married again. That marriage didn't work out. And she had a child at that point, and she did not feel that she could raise the child and keep the light by herself. So she left at the age of 33, a profession that she loved dearly. One of the things that she was known for in her career there was she saved many people's lives who were swimming in Lake Michigan, who would get caught in the riptides and just not realize, you know, how far out they were or that they were soon to be foundering. And in the interview, she talks about how one woman was fighting her as she was trying to save her, and she ended up socking her in the face just to, you know, stop her from getting in the way. And the woman complained when they got back to shore, and she said, well, I had to do that or we were both going to die. So she was quite a character. She just died 2 weeks ago, unfortunately. But she really lived a fantastic life after her position as the keeper. She went to work in office management, office administration, and she did that for another 30 years, so quite a character. There were some tragic ladies in the Ladies of the Lights history. As I mentioned, Mary Terry, starting off, who was discovered after a fire at her lighthouse. And as I said, too, even to this day, that has not been solved. And this is a picture of Julia Sheridan, the Sheridan family of the west side of Michigan, who served in so many lighthouses. She was an assistant to her husband, Aaron, at South Manitou Light. And I'm not quite sure why they were in a boat in March on Lake Michigan, but they left the island with their youngest son, Robert. And they made it to the mainland, did their business there, came back out onto the water, and their boat was capsized. And they fought for some time. There was a fourth passenger who owned the boat, and they fought for some time to hang on to the boat. It was upside down, and they were trying to hang on to each other and hang on to the boat, but the cold water really did them in, and only the man who owned the boat survived. They had five other children, and those boys were all boys, and they were all on the island waiting for them to come back. One of her children actually became a lighthouse keeper after that. It was a very sad story for the Sheridan family. Anna Garrity, that we saw a picture of earlier, the sadness in her career was that even before she became a keeper, she was assaulted by her father's assistant keeper. She was a young teen at that time, living at the New Presqu'île Light with her family. And one of the men she told her father that one of the men had assaulted her, and he actually wrote in his logbook, in a very almost clinical way, that, you know, she had been raped and that man was going to the sheriff's, and, you know, we'll see what happens. Unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be any record of what happened to him, except that he was dismissed from the lighthouse service. But, you know, despite that terrible start to you know, what was a very long career, she persevered, and she was a 23-year veteran of the Lighthouse Service. And then we have our triumphant ladies. As I mentioned, Elizabeth Williams served 41 years. Just as a point of reference to the national female national record holder was 51 years. Anastasia Truckee, this woman here, she managed the Marquette Harbor Lighthouse during the Civil War. Her husband joined, I think it was the 27th Michigan Infantry, and he served for 3 years, and during that time she really kept that light going, and that was a very important light. That was the light that lit the harbor for the ships that were coming in to pick up the iron ore from the iron mines near Marquette. And that iron was then sent off to various areas of the eastern United States and was used to make railroad ties. The barrels for guns, the barrels for cannons, and ammunition. So that was very important that she was the one making sure that light stayed lit and those ships sailed in safely and out. Jane Enos, she served at St. Joseph Lighthouse. She was one of two women who served there. She was the first woman allowed to have male assistants. That was not very typical when there were women lighthouse keepers. They typically served at a smaller light, didn't need an assistant. She served at a larger light, needed assistance, and actually managed two in her career. Anna Garrity also managed a man up at the Presque Isle lighthouses. And there were a number of women who really managed that very big responsibility of maintaining the light while having large, large families. I mentioned Catherine Shook. She had 8 children. Catherine Marvin had 10 children. Not all of them were at home by the time she became a keeper, but still. And a number of others had 6 to 8 children. So the big families of the day didn't stop these women from doing their duty. This is a picture of Mary Corgan, and she married into a lighthouse-keeping family, the Corgans of Lake Superior. And she and her husband were serving on Gull Rock, which is hardly any soil there. It's mostly just a rock and a lighthouse near the tip of the Keweenaw Peninsula. And she went into labor, so they got into the steam-powered launch that they were provided as keepers. She was assistant to her husband, James. And before they made it to the doctor on the mainland, she gave birth. And her husband, in his logbook, described their adventure on the lake in this way. Principal keeper started 8 p.m. in the station boat with wife for Copper Harbor, distant 14 miles. With anticipation of increase soon after arriving. When 1.5 miles east of Horseshoe Harbor, Mrs. Corgan gave birth to a rollicking boy. All things lovely, had everything comfortable aboard, see a dead calm. I like that he ends with the weather. She also gave birth to a child who later became a lighthouse keeper. And there were some second acts in the lives of these keepers. Obviously, someone like Elizabeth Whitney Williams served basically her entire adult career at the two lighthouses and retired at the age of 71. And a number of women were in that age frame when they retired from the lighthouse service. This is a photograph of Carolyn Antaya and her son, Edward. She had married a man, again, one of the disabled Civil War veterans. He died shortly after they had gone to serve at Mama Judah Lighthouse. She took over for him, and she had a little difficulty. The lighthouse inspector didn't think that she should serve there, that a woman should serve there, and she actually had the support of the surrounding communities, and they appealed to the state senator, or the U.S. Senator, Zechariah Chandler, and he took their appeal to the lighthouse service directly in Washington. So she was able to succeed her husband and provide for her children. She had 2 boys at that time. So after he died, she served as a widower for some years. Then she married again. And her second husband, he owned a business up in Port Huron. And I don't know if they had a long-distance relationship, but he maintained that, and she maintained her position at the lighthouse downriver. Finally, she had another child with him, And about a year after that, she wrapped it up. Said, I'm going to move to where my husband lives. So, you know, in her second act, she started a second family with a second husband. Many of the women who were widowed, they remarried. And we've lost track of them, unfortunately. Their names changed. They don't show up on the census in the area. So we're not quite sure what happened to most of those 52 women. And I hope by producing this book and having these talks that I may find out about some of these women over time, because it's a shame that they served so long and so well without much recognition and you know, less and less as the years go by. But that kind of wraps up the history briefly that I've covered in the book. And I always like to give some acknowledgement to those who helped me with it. I don't know if any of you have seen a presentation by Diana Stamfler. She has she gives a presentation both on Michigan Lady Lighthouse Keepers and on ghostly lights. She calls them haunted lights of Michigan. Terry Pepper at the Great Lakes Lighthouse Keepers Association, that's sort of the Great Lakes area primary organization that serves those with lighthouse enthusiasm. And then Phyllis and Thomas Tagg of Great Lakes Lighthouse Research, they, some years ago, they went to the National Archives and wrote down every lighthouse keeper at every light in the Great Lakes. And they composed several books based on, you know, one for each lake. And that is just invaluable information for anyone who's interested in the lakes and their keepers, the lighthouse keepers. Otherwise, we'd all have to travel to Washington and do that work. So, got a lot of information from there. But that sort of wraps up the main part of my presentation. Are there any questions I can answer about? Oh, I guess we have a microphone back. Oh, that's moving around.
Thank you. I'm Claire Dahl. I'm a history teacher, retired from here, and I've been to loads of lighthouses along the Great Lakes. Would you mention something about the incredible difficulty these women had in terms of trying to keep that flame going and the wicks going? And it was not just a matter of surviving on an island. It was brutal, brutal work. Mm-hmm. And I'd also like to know if you've ever slept and stayed in one of the lighthouses for a while.
I have not. On our last trip to the UP, we looked into trying to think, the one that's above Ontonagon, can't think of the name of it. Sandhills, yeah. And, not cheap. So we haven't yet, but we are, I'm speaking up in Paradise at the Whitefish Point Lighthouse this summer, and so we'll get to stay on the grounds then. So I'm excited about that.
And the working conditions?
The working conditions. You know, they were the same as they were for men, but as many of these women were widowed, obviously they were handling this by themselves or having their children help in some ways as they could. The primary duty, obviously, was keeping that light lit through the night, and that could be difficult depending upon the equipment they were provided with. You know, in the early days, these lamps that they had to light and keep lit with oil, which had to be carried up the stairs. But in bad weather, you know, in rain or wind or whatever, that can also impact the ability to keep the lights lit. And there was a separate, I don't know if everyone knows this, but there was a separate part of the federal government that dealt with life saving. So most keepers, at least in the, you know, as time wore on, weren't responsible for saving lives, but many did in the early years. So there was that difficulty. Then there were fog horns that needed to be, blown if the fog, you know, really settled in. So they had to both keep the lights lit in, keep the fog horns going, or bells. Little Traverse Light has a bell, for instance, a fog bell instead of a fog horn. So it really was an all night affair for these women, and then get up and maintain the lights, and keep your family fed and clothed and whatever. So there was quite a bit of the lighthouse service was very particular about the condition of the light stations, keeping things painted and polished and keeping logs of the weather and the supply of oil and you know, just a very labor-intensive, but at the same time, a lot of paperwork to the job, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my grandfather had to unload a lighthouse tender,
mm-hmm.
and the south end of Beaver Island, and it's like 50 feet up. So you'd have to load up a wheelbarrow and go up this hill 50 feet, and I don't know how many times you had to do that.
Yeah.
I can't imagine a woman, you know.
Obviously, the lighthouse tenders were the ships that would come and resupply the lighthouses, and obviously they had crews, so that hopefully they would help with that. I know at Marquette Harbor they have they had an actual, almost like a track that brought materials up to the lighthouse, because it also is located up high up on a cliff. Did you have a question?
In terms of the kinds of writing that you encountered, besides just the keeping of the logs, could you talk about one or two of the writers, just the quality of the writing and what they wrote about, besides just the technical keeping of the light?
In terms of the women, or just in broad?
Yeah, just the women and their journals or letters or whatever you found.
The only two writers that I've really come across are Elizabeth Whitney Williams, who wrote an autobiography, talking about her life as a keeper and her life on Beaver Island. The other person was Grace Holmes, who served at Port Sanilac Light, and she had there's a woman right now in that county who is transcribing her diaries for ultimately to publish them, because not only did she keep track of the things that lighthouse keepers were required to keep track of, the weather and ship traffic and, you know, any unusual happenings, but she recorded what was happening in her community. And she, not in a gossipy way, but in almost a scientific way, is like an anthropologist. There are some quotes about what she observed in the book. So that was a really valuable tool for that county, as far as life during that period that she and her husband served. But the logs were really, they were really required to keep them in a very methodical, basic way. They were told how to do that by the lighthouse service, and some people were a little more poetic than others. Mary Corgan's husband, James, in other log entries that I've seen of his, he just has a way with words. He was a teacher at one point in his career, and it just is reflected in the way he kept his logs. But some were just very basic, one line, two line.
Could you say something about raising children in the lighthouse? I mean, where did they go to school, for example?
If they were in a mainland light, like, for instance, Marquette, which is not far from the community, or wasn't at that point far from the community that it served, they would go to school in that community. But there were others that were more remotely located or were on islands, and that was impossible. The lighthouse service recognized that at one point and started to provide libraries of books that would get rotated in and out with the tenders as they brought supplies. And those books those libraries would have things like a Bible, books on geography, history, songbooks, literature, you know, what was considered the fine literature of the day. So that was their effort to help, in essence, homeschool the children. A lot of the more modern children's accounts that you read, you know, children who were growing up in the 30s and 40s in the lighthouse, in a lighthouse family, they just talk about it being almost a paradise, that they just love to run free on the islands and around the light station and fished and swam and, you know, got into all kinds of mischief. Sometimes, too, children would be schooled on the mainland while their father stayed at a lighthouse, and their mother would travel with them and their father would stay at a lighthouse. So it wasn't, they might be out there for just the summer, actually on the grounds of the lighthouse. So it was a variety of things. Some got homeschooled and some get more traditional schooling. There was one woman who was, her father was the lighthouse keeper at Mama Judah, which happened to be the light in the Detroit River where Caroline and Taya had served earlier. And her father would row her across the river into Wyandotte for school every day and then pick her up at the end of the day. So that's how they handled that.
There were evidently no rules against women being lighthouse keepers, and was some rule of that to that effect put in later to shut them out at all, or were they? Was it always open?
Not initially. It wasn't open to women. I mean, there were very few jobs that were open to women in the 1830s when the first lighthouse opened in Michigan. You know, most women who were working at that time were domestics in some way. But the person who oversaw the lighthouse service in the 1830s recognized that the women who were assisting their husbands in an informal way or off the books, that they, if the husband died, they were likely the best candidate to serve after him. They were there. They were trained. You know, they knew that they would, especially if they had a family to raise, they knew that they would be good employees. So there was actually a comment by that person, his name was Pleasanton, saying that if there is a widow, then give her the job. As I mentioned, when the Coast Guard took over and when the technology changed, then so did the attitudes. You know, some felt that the women couldn't handle the more technically difficult engines that were required to run the foghorns, and so they, you know, just ended up phasing them out at that point.
Was there a rule passed against them, though, at some point? I seem to remember something like that.
Yeah, not an official. There was neither a rule at the beginning nor at the end. It was more of a practice that, you know, became a rule, if you will, and it was really the first federal position open to women.
What materials or resources did you use to do your research? I mean, obviously there were the logs from the lighthouses mm-hmm. and whatnot, but I'm just curious what all you had to, where you got your information from to do this book.
Those records in the National Archives, whether it's the logs or the lists that were derived from the lighthouse service records, those have been, you know, incredibly valuable. The books, there are several books written. There's a book written called Women Who Kept the Lights, which is a national look at women lighthouse keepers, and that was a good starting point for me in looking at the sources that those two authors used. Oh, there it is. There's a copy of it. The Cliffords, that's kind of the Bible, you know, of that. And I think there are two Michigan women that are prominently featured in there. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, Mary Terry and Elizabeth Whitney Williams. So that was kind of the starting point. And then I just read everything I could get my hands on about lighthouse keeping, and usually those authors would write at least a chapter about women. And but that list from the article that I mentioned early on from that was about Mary Terry, that list was really the starting point for, in Michigan, you know, who was involved in this. But there are a lot of, I drew from a lot of newspaper accounts. I had a lot of help from librarians and historical societies in different parts of the state. But I hope to find out more. I hope somebody will come and say, well, I've got a photograph of that person, or I related to that person. The Shooks, Catherine Shook, the first lighthouse keeper, she has a huge family that has spread out through the decades. Her family's in sort of the Thumb area in Bay City, Saginaw, Midland. I've met two of her relatives, and I was able to interview a number of descendants.
Speaking of the photographs, I think it was Elizabeth Whitney Williams, whose husband was a professional photographer,
he was. Mm-hmm.
Wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
So didn't he you know, leave a good record of?
Not that I'm aware of. You know, in contacting the Beaver Island Historical Society, they didn't or couldn't provide much more than two photographs that I have in the book. There are a couple of women we have several photographs for. Carolyn Antaya is another one because she was the aunt of Henry Ford. And so at the Benson Ford Research Center, they have a family file on her original married name, which escapes me right now. Barney something, can't think of his last name. Antaya is her second name. But there's a whole file on her. There's probably half a dozen photographs of her. And then Elizabeth Whitney Williams we have a few photographs of. But most of the other photos in the book, that was all I was able to find, one of each of these other women and many that could find no photographs for. The men in the lighthouse service were photographed formally in their uniforms. The women were not, which sort of signals a little, you know, second-class citizen treatment there. They also did not have uniforms. The men had formal uniforms. The women did not. Probably just a reflection of, you know, not fully accepting or recruiting women for the service.
Did the women get service awards? Or anything?
They did. I know Elizabeth Whitney Williams received an award in her service. None of the women were involved with any shipwrecks that we know of, and just the one, Frances Marshall, the last Lady of Light, was known to have saved people from, you know, from her swimming skills.
Yeah, I haven't looked at your book yet. Do you have a bibliography in
mm-hmm.
it?
Mm-hmm.
And then you mentioned...
Footnoted and everything.
You mentioned a presentation. Do you know if that is on a website or...
The exhibit is a physical thing. You know, it's not an online exhibit, but a physical exhibit. And it's rentable from the museum where I used to work that I've got the brochures for over there, the Michigan Women's Historical Center.
And did any of these women have, like, a government pension or any benefits from their service?
That's a good question. I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure. So often after they served, the record, whether it's in newspapers or books or whatever, of their lives just is incomplete. But I would think they would have been provided with something. It would have been, you know, they were legitimate employees of the Lighthouse Service.
In the record, are there any Native American or African American women that were lighthouse keepers?
No.
And what was the main way the white lighthouses were supplied with food and necessities?
The tenders that you mentioned, the lighthouse supply ships would come by in some periodic fashion, you know, every couple months or whatever. But if it was a remote lighthouse and the person actually left the lighthouse in the winter, then when they returned, they would be returned with supplies that would last them for some duration. You know, sufficient amount of oil and canned goods and whatever. Some of the lighthouses had the land around there could be tilled for some kind of gardening or raising livestock, but a lot, you know, if the lighthouses were on rocks you know, or rocky soil or sandy soil that wasn't conducive to that, it really varied from location to location. Any other questions? Well, thank you for coming out. I appreciate it.